طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone. And welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature a conversation with Palestinian scientist and activist Mazen Qumsiya. Mazen did research and taught medical genetics at both Yale and Duke universities before returning to his hometown of Bethlehem in the West Bank of Palestine. He has authored four books, including the must-read Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle. And he also founded the Palestine Museum of Natural History in Bethlehem at Bethlehem University, where he also teaches. In fact, he teaches in a variety of capacities, which he references in this recorded informal conversation with a delegation from the United States, which was visiting Palestine, Israel. Here is Mazen Qumsiya in conversation.
So, I just got this book, by the way. It's called The Last Gasp, which is air is running out from Earth because of the pollution and all this stuff. So, as we were talking about at the lunch, that we have a huge challenges as a species, and we should get our act together. The question is how, and all my life I've been struggling with this question. But I mean, it was clear from the beginning, from the first time I took biology, that, you know, 4 or 5 decades ago, that that there is a problem on this earth and that we have to do something about it. The question has always been for me is not the ultimate need for doing these things. It's how best to do them and where do I imagine dedicate my time, you know? Should I dedicate in doing this task or that task and this education or that education, this... So my life's mission has been to do something positive, but I haven't always found out exactly where I'm best suited at and where I best... And I still don't know, even though many of the volunteers here, they think I'm like the godfather who knows everything, you know? Like the guru of whatever. But I'm still just as confused as everybody else. So I try to figure out where I best fit as a person and where I best dedicate my time and resources. I have been relatively lucky compared to most Palestinians in the sense that, I mean, lucky, but also worked my ass off to get where I am. I finished my high school. I was actually the best student in the Bethlehem district in high school, and I was offered scholarships including to study medicine in Russia and study engineering in Kuwait and all the stuff which my father wanted me to take. And I said to him, sorry, I'm interested in biology, I'm interested. Said, you're going to spend all the rest of your life chasing rats and bats? I said, yes, if that's what it takes. That's what I enjoy doing. So I want to do something good. And my reasoning for it, my mother was actually the inspiration behind this. She always taught me that it's best to do what you like, not worry about money, and try and do good in society. Again, not worry about money. Money will come regardless of what you do. If you do something you love, you know, people will hire you. So that's indeed what happened. I went into biology and I studied biology and I excelled at it. I even published my first scientific paper while I was an undergraduate, sole author, you know, nobody else. And so then I went for my master. I actually worked for a year and a half before I went to my master degree so that I can save enough money to go to the U.S. And what I did would not be possible to do now, because for a year and a half I worked my ass off, saved enough for the airline tickets, and then and little bit of spending money would have lasted me 3 months in the U.S., about $200, $300 at the time. Now, of course, the U.S. doesn't allow students to do this. You have to have bank money guaranteed to cover everything for your duration for 1 year or 2 years or whatever. So anyway, I went to the U.S., and the professor there at the University of Connecticut told me, well, if I don't have scholarships, but if you work hard and you get good grades in your first semester, I'll find you a scholarship in the second. And indeed, he was to his word. He, you know, I got all A's, even though I was working two jobs in addition to my... I was working at restaurants and switchboard phone operator at the campus and stuff like that. And so anyway, I managed and finished my master and PhD and then did medical genetics, worked in the U.S. for a while. I was planning right after finishing PhD to come back to Palestine, but my time in the U.S. for PhD and master's taught me that the U.S. is really, really important to work in, because without the U.S., Israel would not survive one day. Mm-hmm. It's the U.S. that keeps Israel, yes. Israel doing what it's doing and destroying the way it's destroying and all this stuff.
Yes.
So the work in the U.S. was very important, and I realized very quickly that work activism does make a difference, that you can actually make a difference. And so I stayed in the U.S. longer than I had planned to stay. And also that second reason, which was that because I was so good and people started offering me jobs with good salaries, I thought I'd save enough money so that when I come back here, if the Palestinian Authority or whoever doesn't like me, at least I have enough money that I can eat and drink and nobody will bother me with jobs and I won't have to be dependent on other people. So that's the two reasons I ended up staying in the U.S. much longer than I had anticipated. And I came back here in 2008. And I started to get involved in activism here and try to recreate some of the activism I was doing in the U.S. with boycott, divestment, sanctions, with mobilizing, with demonstrations, with lobbying the media and the politicians, all of the stuff I was doing already in the U.S., but I started doing it here. And then it occurred to me at some point, I don't remember, maybe 2013 or early 2014, that there must be a better way to mobilize, because if you mobilize a demonstration with 20 people, it's different than if you have 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. And how are you going to get people to come? You cannot convince adults very much. It's adults have their ways, they are set in their minds. You have to get to start working with children. So I started working with young people more. In 2013, I taught like 4 or 5 courses. They're not necessarily related to politics or activism or anything, but at least I wanted to be involved with younger university students. And then I even realized that it has to be even younger than university students. So I decided, okay, now I know my direction. And also, I used to give a lot of money to philanthropy, to NGOs here and stuff like that. And I decided, instead of giving them to NGOs, some of them turned out to be corrupt and mm-hmm. things like that. And I was tricked out of a lot of money. I think overall, perhaps I counted over $110,000 that I was duped out of in various ventures with people that turned out to be not patriotic or not honest and things like that. So I decided, okay, I learned my lessons, now I know where to focus my energy, which is I need to work with young people, but I need to be the one to control where the money goes and how it's spent and all this stuff. So I decided I'm going to donate $250,000, my own money, basically what I saved in the U.S. And this is what I decided to do. And then I looked at where to do it. I explored and I decided to do it at Bethlehem University. And the reason I decided to do it at Bethlehem University is a bit complicated. Part of it is also sort of an insurance against Israeli occupation, because Bethlehem University is part of the Catholic Church. It was established by the Pope in 1973, and it's still considered church property and everything else. So I thought, if Israel wants to destroy something that we build, it would be hard for them to destroy something that's technically under the auspices of the Vatican. And that's number one. Number two is it's the only academic institution here in Bethlehem region, and my family is here. My mother is 85 years old, and I want to be next to her all the time. So this is why those two reasons. So I approached Bethlehem University. I said I want to help build a museum of natural history and a botanical garden to reach the children. I told them very honestly also my idea is also that this is empowering youth so that they can liberate themselves. So there's some politics associated with it. It's not strictly scientific or whatever. And I said that's fine, except for two issues. One is how this is managed, and the second is how is it sustainable long term? Which I understand, they don't want to have something built and then they're worried if something happens to me, for example, the whole thing would collapse and would need their support. So I assured them on both fronts that I will take a 5-year transition period. In those 5 years, I'll prove to them that it's sustainable and that it's producing something that benefits the university academically, scientifically, in every other way. So that's how we started this in 2014, mid-2014. Okay, so what's the goal of this? The goal is to do research, education, and conservation, all related to sustainability. Sustainability of our world, whether sustainability in terms of food security or sustainability in form of not destroying the environment or sustainability in form of not nuking each other out of existence, that's sustainability. To me is that humanity needs to think of ways and strategies that we last as a species. That's the overarching principle that guides this. And so for that, you need research. You need good research, because without research, you cannot do any of the other things. You cannot deal with education or conservation or anything environmental conservation if you don't have good research on what you're doing or what is out there. So research is number one, and we focused on research to understand, for example, the impact of human population growth, you were saying, here, the impact of the Israeli settlements on the environment, the impact of the wall on the environment. Israeli industrial settlements, for example, that dump their toxic waste on the Palestinian villages. We did some genotoxicity studies with my master's students. So that's research. And we published in the last 3 years 25 publications, good publications. Which is remarkable for an initial thing that started from scratch. Nothing here. Everything you see here is new. This was originally a dormitory in the 1970s. Mm. That's why each room had a bathroom like this. And so it was a dormitory for girls at Bethlehem University, and now they didn't need it in the 80s when Israel started restricting movements and stuff like that. Most universities in the West Bank became provincial universities, like community colleges, if you want. So they don't have much in the term of far away outside students. Okay, so so research is number one, and then this is followed by education of young people. Education is learner-oriented, not teacher-oriented, so to speak. The idea of the education here, the philosophy of the education that I follow, is this here, respect. Mm-hmm. That we respect ourselves first as Palestinians. We can change our own circumstances. Liberation must come from our own self first. And second comes respect for others. And third comes respect for nature and the environment, and not polluting and recycling and things like that. These are the three levels of respect. And they come from self-learning. We create the environment here for people to learn. We're not teaching them, so to speak. So just like we create an environment for a plant to grow, we provide the environment for the human being to grow, for the child to grow. And just 2 days ago, we had 70 students, age 6 to 12, who were here, and they loved it because they were interacting and building and doing. And this is, for me, a very important thing, is that it's learning by doing. You know, there's a Chinese saying, I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand. So we want them to do things. So, and this is where politics and science all intermix, because you cannot really separate them. If people liberate their minds and they develop this self-respect, then they are less likely to internalize occupation. They're less likely to be mentally occupied. And mental occupation is actually more dangerous than the physical occupation. I'm actually writing a research paper on this now, the mental occupation. People don't pay attention to it, but it's very insidious and it's very far-reaching. Makes you internalize that Jews are better than you, they are God's chosen people, and they are so much more powerful, they have nuclear weapons, they have these armies, and who are you to challenge this system of power? And after all, you're also a savage, like they say you are, and you're emotional, like they say you are. You internalize the derogatory and racist attitude that the occupiers and colonizers give to us. And it's so widespread here, it's incredible. And so, you know, Stephen Biko in South Africa once said, the best weapon in the hand of the occupier is the mind of the occupied. And indeed, if they control our mind, they have this Vichy government here that's now watching for Israeli interests, we have a problem. So, in the 1950s, in the civil rights movement in the US, they used to say, free your mind and your ass will follow. So, we have to free our minds first. So that's where the political agenda comes in, if you want. And I'm not shy about speaking about it, as you see. Everything, by the way, we say here is also recorded, and the Mossad has a record of all of this, so there's nothing secret to hide. So this is my agenda and my strategy. As a person, I only strategize for myself. And I hope that others, of course, see the logic of it and join us. And I was actually pleasantly surprised how many people have seen this logic and have started to work with us. How many volunteers have started to come here. Those two women with the hijabs are volunteers here, okay? the American girl Morgan is a volunteer. We have another two girls that went up to Ramallah today on our behalf, on the behalf of the museum. They're also volunteers. I have actually more volunteers than I can accommodate. So
I can see why.
It is because it's obvious. It's so logical, and the urgency of it is also important for people to understand. There's an urgency that this is no more a luxury. You know, in the old days, colonialism was okay. You know, King Leopold went to Congo from Belgium, killed 1.5 million people. 1.5 million, genocide. And they used to cut people's arms and legs off and things like that. Disaster. But ultimately, that didn't threaten the species. Sorry to say that. It just threatened that local community. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, this colonization, the Israeli colonization, threatens the human species. And people don't realize this, the connections, and I have evidence for this. That's leading us to a nuclear war. It is. I mean, I think Pakistan and India got nuclear weapons because Israel has nuclear mm-hmm. weapons. And they talk about Iran wanting nuclear weapons. I actually don't blame them if they get nuclear. Why not? Mm-hmm. If Pakistan on one side has nuclear weapons, Israel has nuclear mm-hmm. weapons, why don't they get nuclear weapons? Like everybody, look at Korea. Everybody's respecting Korea because they have nuclear weapons. So... There's no serious effort at demilitarization. There's every effort to make things worse. To serve what? To serve Israeli interests here in the Middle East. I think Daesh, the Islamic State, is actually Western creation. U.S., mm-hmm. CIA, yeah. and Israel created the Islamic State. Yes. And they created for what they think is a logical reason. They sometimes think short term, they don't think long term. Mm-hmm. It's like their attack on Iraq. On the short term, they thought we could remove this guy who was against Israel, Saddam Hussein, etc., and this will be good for America, good for Israel, right? They miscalculated. Mm-hmm. The removal of Saddam Hussein actually strengthened Iran, strengthened Hezbollah, strengthened the connection between them and made Iraq actually more an ally of Iran instead of being opposed to Iran. And this was a miscalculation on their part. But the reason they went to war in Iraq and they spent $1 trillion of my taxes and your taxes mm-hmm. on it, $1 trillion what it cost them. Actually more, I think. But anyways.
I think more.
Yeah. The reason they did it is for Israel, not for oil, by the way. This is a mistake to say it's for oil. It's not for oil, it was for Israel. The war in Iraq was for Israel. And there's every evidence for that. The oil companies were against it. Yeah, the CEOs of all the oil companies were against it. They wanted the U.S. to open to stop the embargo on Iraq and to invest in Iraq and have business as usual and bid on Iraqi oil. The evidence of this is also after the U.S. invaded Iraq and occupied Iraq, and they opened up the bids on the oil companies, the Chinese companies, the French companies, the Russian companies are now getting the oil of Iraq, not the American companies. Shell has a very tiny piece. So it was clearly, the thought was, we dismember Iraq, and this will create a friendly state for Israel because Saudi Arabia is friendly, the Emirates are friendly, Jordan is friendly, Egypt is friendly. There's Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. And so let's start with the weakest spot, which is Iraq. And then we'll go to the next weakest spot, which is Syria. That's also why they went to Syria, because Syria is the weakest link between Iran on the east and Lebanon on the west.
And what about Libya?
Libya was taken earlier. Libya is actually, it was, in a way, it's positive that what happened to Libya happened before, but that's another miscalculation that the Americans did with NATO. You know, they asked Gaddafi to remove any nuclear facility and everything and get inspectors, everything else. He obeyed them to the T, and they still removed it. So Syria and Iraq, they knew that this, you know, doing what the West tells you to do is not a guarantee of anything. So it was a lesson well learned, and also Russia and China learned from the Libyan lesson. Because Libya indeed was, the oil of Libya is now divided between France, England, Italy, and the US. That's why the oil of Libya is. And Libya is basically is a dysfunctional state. It's totally catastrophic. People are still dying in Libya, but the oil of Libya is still being pumped. And this is what concerns us. But anyway, Libya is was a cakewalk compared to Syria and Iraq. And the reason for that, I think, has to do with China and the U.S. and Russia. Mm-hmm. China and Russia looked at what happened to Libya and they said, we cannot allow what happened to Libya happen to Syria or Iraq, which are at the key junctions in the Middle East. So they stood their grounds and they didn't allow the U.S. to pass any resolutions in the UN that would impose sanctions on Syria and things like that. So, but the bottom line, geopolitically, the US succeeded in Libya and Israel, of course, because they are connected. But they had failed in Syria and Iraq. And now they really are biting their lips about what happened in Syria and Iraq, because it actually strengthened China and Russia's position in the Middle East, and they don't know what to do. They cannot, because China and Russia will not allow the U.S. to do in Syria what they did in Libya. No matter how bad the dictator of Syria is, he's much better than the dictators that are puppets of the U.S., like the Saudis or... Saudi Arabia is the worst country in the Middle East, next to Israel, in my humble opinion.
Okay. Sorry.
So, this is my story and I'm sticking to it.
Marvelous approach.
Can you give us just an overview? Can you just give us an overview of what the museum is doing? You know, how you've divided the job here and
well, this is what the film will show you. So I think maybe I'll show you the film.
Okay, that'd be great. And then
I would like very much to read some of the papers that you look at most favorably.
Yeah, yeah.
Your thinking is just. So stimulating.
I wrote a book about called "Sharing the Land of Canaan: Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle." Mm-hmm. In it, I describe basically a little bit of the history and the you know, you're in the medical field, so I say it like I did to the medical students at Duke and Yale. You know, okay, you take a patient history. Why do we take a patient history? To understand a little bit when the first symptoms are always, how the progression of the disease happened, so that you can make the right diagnosis, right?
That's the main.
So the problem is for many people regarding social...
A little bit more, who are you?
Yes.
How did you get to this
point? Right, how did you get to this point? So that what? So that you can make the correct diagnosis and apply the correct therapy and then give the right prognosis relative to the therapy, right? The problem is, for social phenomena, people don't do that. For social phenomena, what do? They look at some of the symptoms and they say, ha, that's a problem. Okay, you know, like there's violence here. So there's some Israelis, some Zionists, others. There's violence. There's Hamas. Okay. There's Hamas. But it's like somebody having cancer, having symptoms, like, let's say, skin rash or headache. They say, the problem is the headache. Give them some aspirin. Well, I'm sorry. You know, the aspirin may help temporarily relieve the headache, but it is not going to solve the underlying etiology of the disease. You have to understand what's the problem here. Why is there a problem? Most people don't think about social, not even Palestinians, by the way. I bet you go take 10 people here in the street and ask them, why is there a conflict here? What's the problem here? You'll get maybe 10 different answers. Because they take our land, or because they did this to us, or because they did that to us. But that's not a diagnosis. That's a symptom. They did this to you as a symptom of something deeper than that. What is the deeper thing? And you start to question them, and many of them get confused because they have never even given it a thought about why we have a problem. Why do we have a problem? When did the patient start having symptoms? Is it 1948, 1967? What is the problem? Where did this start? So take a proper patient history. So the patient, if you follow it historically and you understand when it started, it started in 1880. Mm-hmm. 1880 is the first Zionist colony in Palestine, long before Herzl even. 1880, they created a Zionist colony called Petah Tikva. And in the Petah Tikva symbolism was creating a Jewish state, Jewish labor, Jewish products, Jewish this, Jewish that, and no consideration of the natives whatsoever. The natives don't belong here. The natives are interlopers on the land of Israel. This is our land that God gave us, this land. This is Zionism, the political idea of Zionism, creating a Jewish state. It's a political idea. What is this Zionism about? How did this come about? Why? Why did it start in the mid to late 19th century? Also, people don't think about that, to understand it a little more. Why? Because in the 19th century, the age of empires in Europe was ending, and the age of nation-states was being built. So when you have nation-states instead of empires, instead of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you had the Germany and Hungary and Austria, whatever. Nation-states, by definition, they had to discriminate and distinguish among their residents, so they started discriminating against people who are minorities. If you have a Catholic majority state, it discriminates against Protestants and Jews and Gypsies and everybody else. And vice versa, if it's a Protestant, discriminating against Catholics. And so discrimination against minorities mushroomed in Europe in the 19th century. Grew. Logical. Again, not justifying or anything, I'm just describing a historical phenomenon. Okay, so discrimination grew, means anti-Semitism grew, etc. Logical, if you were a Jew in Europe in the 19th century, what is your choices? There's one of two choices for humans facing danger. What are they? Fight or flight, right? Sure. Just like animals. So we either fight discrimination and we say we are going to challenge, etc. Majority of people do that. Or you can say, heck with it, I can't live with these white people. They are always going to discriminate against you. So let me go make my own thing. Self-empowerment, whatever. The blacks in America, they did the same thing, by the way, in the 19th, early 20th century. The majority of them fought discrimination. There was a minority who said, you cannot live with white people. We have to empower ourselves. We have to have a country of our own. And let's go back to Africa. And they did, and they created a country called Liberia. You know Liberia. Mm-hmm. Yes. Liberia is an American black colony. It was created by American blacks. Mm-hmm. The problem for them, of course, Liberia was not a land without a people, for a people without a land. There were people there. Mm-hmm. Same with the Jews in Europe. When they came here, when Herzl sent two rabbis to Palestine in 1897 to look it over, and see how suitable it is for a Jewish colonial state. And by the way, that's the term they used. They said Jewish Colonial Association is the name they gave themselves. Jewish Colonial Association. When he sent those two rabbis in 1897, they looked over the country. Before they wrote their full report, sent it to Vienna, they sent a telegram to Vienna. And what did the telegram say? It said, the bride is beautiful, but she's married to another man. Yeah. It's a wonderful country for a Jewish state, but there are people here. What are we going to do with these people? So kick them out. And that's the least they could do, by the way. They could have chosen the other option, the option of genocide, for example, like happened in Australia, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, United States. Genocide is could have been an option. But they chose a lesser of two evils, so to speak. They chose ethnic cleansing. So today we have 7 million of us Palestinians are refugees or displaced people. 7 million. My grandmother comes from Nazareth, for example. And I'm not allowed to go visit Nazareth by Israeli law. So, anyways, the point that I'm trying to make is if you understand this, it actually makes things so much more logical, and it makes the therapy also more easier, and it gives you optimism. It's not a bad diagnosis to say that this is a colonial, anti-colonial struggle. It's actually a good diagnosis. It's better than to say the diagnosis is a religious war.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine if that's the real diagnosis, a religious war. Or the real diagnosis is that Muslims hate Jews. That's not a good diagnosis, okay? So colonialism is actually a fairly good, mild diagnosis. Why? Because it's very common in here. It's like having flu, you know, or having a cough or something. It's very common. Just about every country on earth was either a colonizer or a colonized country. So you have a lot of other patients to compare your illness to and decide where to go from here. And there are three possible outcomes for colonial, anti-colonial struggles. Three possible scenarios. There's no fourth scenario. First scenario is the colonizers lose and the natives win. That's very rare.
I was wondering if there's a...
Can you find a country where the natives won?
Yeah.
I can only think of one, by the way. Algeria. Hmm. 1 million French colonizers packed their bags and went to Europe. At the cost of 1 million Algerian lives.
That's right.
It was massacres until they won. Very rare that this happens in human history, that the colonizers lose. And I don't say went back to France, because some of them were 5-6 generations in Algeria. Mm-hmm. Some of them have not even touched the French soil before. So they had to go. That's the thing. But this is rare and it won't happen here. No Palestinian faction, even Hamas and Islamic Jihad, which are very radical, are not calling for the Algerian model. The second model, or second scenario, is the other way around. The colonizers win and the natives lose. Or at least they lose 98%. And that can only happen by genocide, really, if you think about it. Natives are so resilient that the only way you can really is to do enough killing of them, that there's so few of them, like in Australia, there's so few Aborigines, that you can even, Australia now has an annual day where they call it Apology Day, where the Australian whites apologize to the natives who remain, the Aborigines, saying we're sorry that our ancestors butchered your ancestors. That's possible. But it's also uncommon. I can think, as I said, Australia, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, there's no natives left, by the way. Mm. Not one. They're all killed. Yeah. Not a single Papua New Guinean remains, even though there are some people on the island who claim that they were grandchildren of some child who was a bastard child of a marriage between a white and a Papua. But anyways, who knows? There's just, it doesn't matter. At this point, there's no possibility whatsoever of Papua New Guinea being returned to the natives or of Australia being returned to the Aborigines. This is very rare also. You know, you can count a few countries on one hand, maybe two.
Or the U.S.
U.S. also. U.S. is, yeah, it's so few Native Americans anyway. By the way, even if the U.S. does what Australia did and apologize, which the U.S. has not done,
we have not really done.
No.
But if they do that, and even if they choose to give $1 million to every Native American who remained in the U.S. and give them 100 acres of land or whatever, the U.S. would not even flinch, would be totally irrelevant to its progress and its history and its economy or anything else. But again, that's a rare situation. What about all the other countries? What about Central America, South America, Caribbean islands, Philippines, Indonesia, you know, Taiwan, Malaysia, all these countries which had colonization before, or some countries in South Africa like South Africa or Rhodesia, what's now Zimbabwe. In all these countries, the third scenario was very obvious. They've given up the colonial idea and they intermarry. They live together in one country. Right? This is the most common outcome for the patient, if you want to use the medical terminology, based on other patient histories, right? So that's the most likely to happen here, eventually. Whether it takes 5 years or it takes 50 years, eventually that's what will happen here. There's no fourth outcome, there's no fourth scenario. Sorry, it has never happened in history that colonials and anti-colonials, for example, decide to split the country between them. Doesn't happen. It's impossible for many reasons which I discuss in this book called Sharing the Land of Canaan. It's impossible.
Sharing
the Land of Canaan. It's available, I think, in French.
It could be in English, doesn't matter.
I do have one French book, by the way, if you want.
I had
my book on popular resistance in Palestine. It's in French. This book, after I wrote Sharing the Land of Canaan, which has to do with diagnosis and prognosis, this was the therapy book. The modalities of therapy, the prescription, if you want. which is what? How do we get the patient from this stage of illness to a stage of recovery? It's a simple thing. It's not very complicated, by the way.
Oh, really? Tell me.
Well, I mean, the outcome is very obvious, as I said. You look at Mexico, for example. Can you tell a Mexican if he is of Spanish ancestry or native ancestry? Mm-hmm. They're all intermarried and finished. The history is gone. They no longer even consider these issues. This is the aim we are going to get to. Or Brazil, Portuguese, you know, we're in Brazil. So things change. Now, how do we accelerate this change? Is the only question that remains. What supplements, vitamins and prescriptions or whatever you want to give to accelerate the process? Well, the best medicine, of course, is the person's own immune system. So you want to stimulate the immune system, which is the resistance, right? So that's why it's called Popular Resistance in Palestine, a History of Hope and Empowerment. Is how to get this history of hope and empowerment stimulated to achieve the final result of ending this colonial tragic part of history that has been very damaging to everybody. It has been damaging also to Jews, by the way, around the world.
Absolutely.
It's been extremely damaging. And it's time for many Jews to realize that this is, as one of my Jewish friends said, this is the worst thing to happen to Judaism in 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. Perhaps even worse than what the Nazis did. Because the Nazis tried to destroy European Jews, and they failed miserably at it. What succeeded is Zionism. Zionism destroyed European Jews. It's not Nazism. Nazism did not eliminate the Ashkenazi culture nor the Yiddish language. It was Zionism that destroyed the Yiddish language. Mm-hmm. In my humble opinion.
I totally agree.
Yeah, I agree. discussion so the other day.
That was an informal conversation with professor, activist, and author Mazen Kumsiya, with a group from the Boston area who were visiting Palestine, Israel, and it was recorded in Bethlehem. Before we sign off this week, we want you to know about a conference being planned in Cambridge entitled Balfour's Legacy, Confronting the Consequences, which is to be held on November 11th at the First Parish Church in Harvard Square. This conference marks the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, which committed Britain to the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine without consulting the indigenous population. It will explore the consequences of this British commitment and how we in the United States can push for a just resolution of a century-old conflict with equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. Among many exciting speakers will be Thomas Suarez, Youssef Munayer, Thomas Aboud, Susan Akram, Nadia Ben Youssef, Amal Bashara, Layla Farsek, Rami Khoury, and that is only a partial list. The date again is November 11th, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., First Parish Church in Harvard Square. It is free and open to the public. A donation of $10 is requested but not required, and a $5 donation for lunch. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.